process for the state. On page 9, the next item that we were package we were looking at was package 050, which is the fund shift package. You'll notice that we have eliminated $124 million of the tobacco settlement money, which was one-time funds for the 2001-03 biennium. We spoke about that yesterday. You also see that it added $220 million, roughly, of tobacco tax money, which is a continuation of the 60-cent temporary or the 60-cent tax that was approved by voters in September of 2002. The net was an increase of general fund to eliminate or the net increase of the general fund backfill for that. Package 060 are simply technical adjustments. With the process of reorganization, because we're still in the process of reorganizing at the time we developed budget, there were some technical adjustments that transferred money within or among DHS clusters. And in this example, the majority of that is transferring money that had been placed in the developmental or senior and people with disability services for the developmental disability program. It should have been placed in the mental health program, and we're just shifting between budget categories within the department. Overall, the 060 package or the technical adjustment package department-wide ends up saving about $9 million, so simply transferring among categories. Page 10 is where we're going to start on the revenue reductions, and you'll see that there is a reduction of $88 million of total funds. That is almost exclusively the loss of the 10-cent temporary tax that's dedicated to the Oregon Health Plan. That money or that tax is proposed to continue as package 187, which you will see down below. The next three packages all relate to action, actually the next four or five packages all relate to rolling up the decisions that the legislature made either through emergency boards or through a series of special sessions. Nothing in there should be new for those who have watched the emergency board or the legislative special session process. We're just simply carrying those things forward. The ones I will highlight is that package 081, you'll notice that we eliminated the mental health services money, or actually we added that money at the third special session. It is reversed in package 084, the November rebalance. I turn to page 11. Package 082, just to highlight for you that the Oregon Children's Plan, we eliminated the funding for the alcohol and drug, the chemical dependency / mental health services through the Oregon Children's Plan. And then in package 084, I'd highlight for you that we had significant changes in the budget for the November emergency board. We had caseload projection declines and also some changes in program related to the Oregon Health Plan standard population, where we eliminated mental health services, chemical dependency services, dental services, and some others. If I turn to page 12, page 12 and 13 are the guts of the governor's budget, and those include package 091, which was the, in effect, the roll-up of the ballot measure 28 program, or the roll-up of the cuts that occurred because of the failure of ballot measure 28. That package rolled up for $205 million of general fund reduction and $458 million of total funds reduction. I have highlighted for you the largest dollar amounts, and I think what you'll see on this page is everything down to about $8 million. There are a series of additional reductions beyond this, but I wanted to keep it tight and just highlight the large ones for you. What I would note with the 091 packages, as you've seen with all the other budgets within the Department of Human Services, this is the list that was presented in December. Since that time, this list has changed, and what will be in the reshoot budget, which will come out in April, will have a slightly different mix to this. So I did want to highlight that for you. Package 092 is on page 13, and these are the reductions that the governor took above and beyond the ballot measure 28 reductions. And as everyone on this committee is aware, the largest single change there was eliminating inflation, utilization, and cost growth for all programs, state employees, school districts, and the largest individual piece for the Department of Human Services comes out of the Oregon Health Plan. As we've talked about before, and as Representative Westland's committee is struggling through, It is a very, very large increase, and is very questionable as to whether or not you can actually implement that and maintain the delivery system we currently have. The other reductions, in addition to the utilization inflationary increases, there were three targeted reductions to the Oregon Health Plan, eliminating adult dental services for all Oregon Health Plan clients, eliminating or creating a prior authorization model for fee-for-service clients, and then finally changing the way that we collect third-party reimbursement for pharmaceuticals and how we collect that money. Though that package by itself accounts for a reduction of $377 million, and that is probably one of the issues that is going to get the most discussion as this committee walks through the Oregon Health Plan. The remaining packages, Madam Chair, and I roll through these fairly quickly, the last two pages, are smaller packages that relate either to other fund increases or fee increase packages or specific smaller programs. And the first two that you see on this page, package 165 and 166, our public health program primarily, actually I shouldn't say primarily, has a lot of fee-based programs in it. People that operate pools and spas have to pay a fee from which the department actually covers some of the costs of doing the enforcement and inspection process. These packages 165 and 166, propose fee increases to cover the increased cost of maintaining those programs. We turn to page 14. That is the last five packages during this budget. The Conrad 20 program, I think it was mentioned yesterday, this package basically allows us to get international medical students into underserved areas in rural Oregon. And this package allows their clinics or themselves to pay the fee involved in getting that special visa. Packages 171 and 173 involve continuing or establishing positions related to either grants, which is package 173, limited duration positions related to grants that were approved during the biennium this last 2001-03 cycle, or as in the case of package 171, where we're trying to add positions to increase our monitoring of the Women, Infant, and Children's Program, which is, or you may have heard of it as the WIC program, which provides nutritional benefits for children and young mothers.
I believe that's a finable offense, ma'am.
He's going to pay in advance for all of the entire time that he comes for the committee.
Madam Chair, I will be in front of this committee for about a month and a half. I will
and
have plenty of opportunities.
Senator Carter isn't here. Representative Wesson is taking over her responsibilities today. Thank you.
The last package that I want to speak with you about is package 187, which is the last one on this page, which is the continuation of that 10-cent temporary tax. And this accounts for about $24 million of tobacco tax increase, or equates to about $80 million of total funds. If this package is not approved, the governor's budget includes elimination of the Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP program, which provides health care benefits for young children, and some additional cuts to the Oregon Health Plan. Madam Chair, that is the end of my presentation.
Are there any questions? Senator Morris.
I have two questions, Madam Chair. Thank you. Do we have any federal funds that are not requiring general fund match? And if so, are they de minimis or are they fairly significant?
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, we do have some federal fund streams that don't require any general fund match. They are fairly small. They're primarily public health grants that have come through. I think some of the bioterrorism mental health block grant has some, but they're dedicated to very specific specific programs that are coming out. We also have some other programs where there may be a maintenance of effort requirement, so it's not directly a match, but we do have general fund tied to the continuation of that federal stream. So the ones, Senator Morris, that are not match or maintenance of effort requirements are fairly small.
Second question. Thank you. I've noticed that central services has increased in the governor's budget approximately $30 million. I don't know whether it would come from budget management or LFO, a breakdown of what that represents. I think that would be important for us to look at.
Madam Chair, we will work with the department and have that broken out for you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Naughton. Barry, we're going to hear mental health and addiction services program overview.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Barry Cast, Assistant Director for Health Services, and we are launching today a discussion of our mental health and addictions programs. And in a few moments, I'll be joined by Bob Nickel, who is the Acting Administrator of the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. To follow up, however, on Mr. Naughton's presentation, to put in perspective for alcohol and drug and mental health, the cuts that were made during the current biennium that are reflected in the 03-05 budget for alcohol and drug abuse were $7.6 million, but they rolled forward to $41.8 million in service reductions in the coming biennium in this budget. In mental health, we made $18.8 million in reductions and $102 million of 03-05 impact. The reason for this, of course, is because these cuts were made late in the session and don't reflect a full 24-month impact. And I think that as you consider what the impact of this budget is, we've put some documentation in our text that gives you some sense of the effect of these reductions on service levels. We begin in the second tab in your books. It's in my book, it's a green tab. It's section 2. And I want to say a few things before I introduce Bob. This program area includes mental health services, both inpatient in the state hospital and in community hospitals, as well as community-based services. And these are services for both adults and for children. In addition, we have alcohol and drug abuse programs across a range of services from outpatient to residential care. And finally, we have a mandated gambling addiction program. I believe it's 1% of the lottery fund revenues are dedicated to treating people who have a problem with gambling. And as I mentioned a moment ago, this is one of the areas in the budget for health services most affected in terms of service levels by the budget reductions. I hope by the time we're done with this 2 to 3 day discussion, you will understand some of the history of mental health services in the state, some of the science that these services are based on, because I think there is still a need for more clarity about the fact that we know what we're doing when we treat people who are ill, and that mental illnesses are just as much an illness as any other general medical diagnosis, that you will understand something about how we provide those services and how they're organized administratively and clinically, and the complex arrangements which we have with our community providers and partners that are under severe stress because of changes in financing. Mental health services, including addiction services, have been for over a century a unique obligation of the state. And Mr. Nickel will talk more in detail about this, but mental health references go all the way back to the very founding of the territorial government. We created a state hospital in the 1880s that was in part done to contain costs because of the growth of people with serious mental illness in that period in our history. And the growth of those hospitals was dramatic and rapid. Because of the growth of the hospital and a combination of civil rights recognition and new technologies in the 1950s, the Mental Health Division was organized. In the 1960s, the Mental Health Division was organized to take control of those institutions and to begin developing needed community programs. And that's what we've really been doing for the past 40 years. And it is not widely known, but we actually hospitalized many people with addictive disorders in those days, and the last remnant of state hospital wards dedicated to treating alcoholism, late-stage alcoholism, and other drug disorders was in the early 1980s. It's important to say, and I think the Surgeon General of the United States in his report a couple of years ago made it very clear, that these problems are extraordinarily prevalent. In any six-month period, according to the epidemiologists in what was then the National Institutes of Mental Health, about 20% of the public has some kind of disorder in any six-month period. Now, that isn't just severe mental illness, but includes phobias and anxiety disorders and all kinds of substance use and abuse disorders. This is a growing area of concern. The World Health Organization now predicts that by the year 2010, depression and addictive disorders will be two of the top 10 disorders in world health. And I think they're close to the top, not to the bottom. Schizophrenia affects 1 to 1.5% of the state's population. That's a substantial number of people. I won't calculate it, but I'm thinking 50, 60,000 people probably are affected by schizophrenia in our state. So you can see that from these numbers that literally hundreds of thousands of Oregonians have some concern or some degree of impairment from mental health and addictive disorders. And we know that to be the case because these illnesses affect costs in virtually every other part of our, not just human service system, but our society. For example, it's becoming more costly to educate children who have a right to be educated in a public setting, but if their needs for mental health treatment are involved, they have a right to have those provided to them. In law enforcement, we've seen a growing fraction of people incarcerated who have mental disorders. And we've known for a long time that a very high fraction, perhaps as much as 80% of the people in custody, have some kind of alcohol or other drug disorder. Our child welfare system is driven in part by alcohol and drug abuse. And other health costs rise. In the health plan, when we built that plan and did the costing, there are costs that are offset in physical medicine because we provide mental health services, and they're captured in the actuarial rates. So the point here is that these are drivers of costs that your subcommittee is facing in other areas of human services, and other subcommittees are dealing with as well. These are, in effect, the costs of not providing treatment. And with regard to treatment, these diseases are readily treatable. Although there are some people who don't respond to treatment, most people do. The rates of recovery from mental illnesses rival or exceed those of recovery from heart disease and other kinds of physical ailments. There's been plenty of research about this, but in terms of the relationship between survival and coronary bypass graft, for example, and the treatment of schizophrenia, the treatment of schizophrenia is very effective and produces at least as good results. And we know, for example, that new medicines, new technologies, more efficient forms of psychotherapy, behaviorally oriented, and early intervention with severe mental illness substantially reduce future cost. And of late, and this is probably the most significant development in the past several years, is that we're thinking not just in terms of rehabilitation for people with serious mental illness, but also recovery so that a normal life awaits people who have these illnesses in the community. When the Mental Health Division was formed in 1961, there were 5,000 beds in our state hospitals dedicated to people with mental illness. Today, more than two-thirds of our resources are expended in the community. But as you'll see as we discuss the impact of the changes in the budget, the state hospital is relatively less impacted by the reductions, and the shift is taking place in the other direction. So we're moving back toward a more institutional model. And it's, I think, a legitimate question to discuss here about where we want to be in 5 years. Do we want to reinvest our mental health policy in institutional care, or do we want to continue to offer services in community settings and a more or a less restrictive form of treatment and life.
Barry, what are some of the drivers that's pushing it more towards institution versus community?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
What are some of the drivers? You mentioned that we appear to be going more towards institution.
Right.
Can you give me some sense of the causals of that?
Yes, I can, Madam Chair. As we have moved more toward a community-based approach, We've been able to avail ourselves of matching funds, federal funds, because of a policy at the federal level which precludes payment for state hospital services for adults. This policy goes back to the mid-19th century, believe it or not, but the point is that in the Medicaid program, the federal government will not pay for state hospitals. And over the years, we've taken patients from the state hospital who were served on general funds. We've moved them to community settings and put them on the health plan. So as the health plan has come under pressure, there's less resource available to serve those people. And in the absence of coverage, for example, for the standard population, when those people become seriously ill and require extended care, we don't know where else we'll be able to serve them except to an inpatient kind of program like the state hospital. In addition, there's a growing forensic population. These are people who have serious mental illness and have committed crimes. And that population, as you'll hear in the next couple of days, is growing by approximately 1.5 to 2 beds per month. During the last two interims, we've opened two wards. We postponed one that was scheduled. And in this budget, there are three new wards for 90 beds that are scheduled to open to accommodate the forensic population. Finally, when we were mandated to take reductions in this budget, and those reductions were proportional across the department, many of our general funds, where the general funds really remained that were flexible and that could be reduced, were in community crisis services and basic outpatient-type services for people who aren't eligible for Medicaid. And so as that resource reduces, just the proportion of resources in the budget shifts to the state hospital. It's not a deliberate policy on the part of the legislature or the administration to increase the size of the state hospital, and indeed it's been state policy for many, many years to look for ways to find community solutions that don't require additional hospital capacity. I draw your attention to the organizational table, which in my book at least precedes this section. And we've shaded the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services and identified the basic structural components of that office: community services, planning and operations, the two state hospitals, and we also operate on behalf of seniors and people with disabilities, a training center in Pendleton, because those two have been together for so many years, indeed since 1913. Of the total FTE in this branch, 1,322 FTE, 1,390, of the total FTE, which is about, I'd have to add these up, I'm sorry, about 1,426, 1,397 are located in the state hospitals, and 109 are positions in the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services that provide program support for those state hospitals and for the community programs. In the community, there are about more than 300 contractors, including our county programs and the direct providers of service that we do business with, residential programs and the like. They operate more than 400 service sites around the state. And just to give you some sense of the proportion of services, in the last 2-year period, we served in alcohol and drug abuse services more than 70,000 Oregonians, and in the mental health component, more than 125,000. And of that total, barely 1% was served in state hospital settings. That makes it very much more dramatic when you think that the state hospital is consuming 50-55% of the resources in this governor's balanced budget. We have a commitment to housing and residential services, and we note and have documented in our summary for you that the proportion of services going to racial and ethnic populations that were previously underserved is increasing, particularly among African Americans and Hispanic Oregonians. Within alcohol and drug abuse, alcohol still remains our highest service area, but heroin and methamphetamine programs for the treatment of those use of those drugs is growing. Mr. Nickel will present to you some of the more detailed effects of the trends affecting service that I identified yesterday. But I hope this brief introduction gives you some sense of the proportion of issues in this program. Let me point out that a portion of the mental health and addictions budget is in the Oregon Health Plan. It's about $413 million. It's actually a part of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. And I was about to say OMAP, and I realized that I have not committed the acronym crime yet, and I'm absolutely astonished at my ability to do that. The Office of Medical Assistance Programs has the budget, but we feel from a policy perspective that we ought to talk now about how that budget in the health plan works with the balance of our resources. And that comes to $496 million in community and state hospital settings. And to break that down for you, of that $496 million, $86 million of that is in the addictions area, that is alcohol and drug abuse treatment. And I think I mentioned yesterday that while we've integrated the administration of alcohol and drug abuse with the administration of our mental health programs, we still track and maintain a clear firewall between the resources that you have asked us to invest in the treatment of these disorders in their separate categories. Over time, we may see some shifts in that, but we would not do that without clear legislative direction and agreement. So $86 million in alcohol and drug abuse programs and $384 million in our mental health program. And to put it in perspective again, of that $384 million, $206 is in state hospital services. With that, and I hope I'm going to stay here with you through the presentation of each of our offices, we can get back to these numbers and explore them in more detail.
Barry, I get 370. So where's the, 470, the other 26 million?
Madam Chair, 22% is in what's called program support. Those are staff and expenditures that support the program expenditures. Program, as you may recall, are special payments that are made not for state employees but for community contracts. The one exception is that we have included in our budget for program the state hospital operations because they are direct services. So $22 million in program support, $1.2 million in central administration, and there's a $2.9 million budget for what's called the Office of Investigations and Training, which is under statute obliged to investigate allegations of abuse and neglect in institution settings and in people in community services. And that should be pretty close to 496, but I rounded a little bit, so I think that's a pretty accurate.
Just a question that we had with one of the other budgets and looking at indirect costs or those costs that in working with the counties, is there a standard percentage that is used for indirect costs? Or are the contracts negotiated just based on specific line items?
Madam Chair, I think if I understand your question, you ask about administrative costs at the contractor or local level.
Yeah.
Most of what we do is financed through county government. We do have a local administration service element, which is actually a portion of which is matched with federal funds. It amounts to about 2.5% of the total budget. I don't know if there's a standard, but we do have pretty good information about the costs of administration in healthcare settings, and which runs from a low of about 5.5% for a certain HMO that we know about to about 27% in some healthcare settings. So I think one of the concerns we've had over the years is that we've never reflected accurately the cost of administration in the way in which we budget for services. Many counties support those dollars that we send them with additional county general funds. I don't know if there's a standard for mental health, but we can certainly look for it.
Would you look for a standard for both mental health as well as the AMD contracts?
Be happy to.
Thank you.
With that, I'd like to introduce,
Representative Wessler.
Well, I don't know if I want to add any more joy to this rambunctious party, but I don't believe that the numbers we're discussing here, the 96 or the 384, have been adjusted for what we call the Bates factor, which is...
That's not switching bait, is it?
No, this is something different.
But as we went through and we budget, the Bates factor will become much more significant to us because these numbers are based off, obviously, the governor's balanced budget, and since that time we have lost a given percentage of revenue, and we generally calculate that as opposed to the percent of increase the governor used, we'll probably be down about 10% from that. So these numbers need to be reduced, at least the general fund portion, by about 10%.
I think we will state it again that the numbers that we're hearing for all of the DHS budgets in this overview, that there will be a reshoot in April. So, even though we're looking at these figures, they will be changed as we work towards the new numbers. Is that not correct, Mr.
Mayor? That's correct, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
I need to defend myself here for a moment, if I could.
Do you need defending?
I think so.
Go ahead.
In the work group for Oregon Health Plan, we did basically reshoot the governor's budget. It was some pretty straightforward math, I thought, but somehow it was not quite calculated right, and the difference was somewhere between $60 and $80 million for the program. That has now become known in this building as the Bates factor. Now, I tell you, it's something I do watch carefully to make sure that we are talking the right numbers so that we know what we're talking about. I will take credit for finding the mathematical error, but it's not my fault that we're $80 million short. I just did the math.
Yeah. Well, you either do 1 and 1 is 2, or you do 3 and 1 is 2. I mean, so, I don't know how you did the math.
I did it right.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much. Can you tell me if the Office of Investigations and Training maintains the same level of budget funding in the governor's budget?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I assume you mean as previously in the current budget. And I believe that there were positions that were to be filled in that office reflecting the increased level of services to developmentally disabled people, and some of those positions have been deleted from the budget and may be postponed or may never appear. But the office reflects workload, and we expect the workload in that office to increase, but it has not in the governor's balanced budget.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At some point, and this should probably come from Mr. Nickel, I would like to hear some discussion of Senate Bill 18, which is focused on abuse and neglect investigations, and what should be our understanding about budget implications, and also what the department's current position is with regard to that legislation, which is now over in the House, I believe.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, we expect on Thursday that Eva Kutas, who is the chief in that office, will be here to discuss what that office does. It'll be a brief discussion. Again, it's very clear and direct. It was the subject of some concern and some review of deaths in community settings in the recent months. And we want you to understand what the facts are about that. And when Eva is here, she will be prepared to talk about Senate Bill 18.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, I want to recognize first that we've had a change in leadership in the Office of Mental Health and Addictions Programs. Dr. Brand, Ann Brand, who is here for a little more than a year, is moving on to pursue other things. And I want to thank her for her service. She came to us with a huge reservoir of knowledge about managed care, risk management, and the kinds of things that we're going to be talking about here. In her place, we've appointed Bob Nickel as acting administrator of that office. Bob has been with us for many, many years and is well known to both the addictions and mental health communities. I think it's a good choice, and Bob is prepared to take up this position with continuity with the past. and I'm pleased to introduce him to you, and he will make the presentation on mental health and addiction services.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's good to be here, I think. My name is Bob Nickel, and as Barry has noted, I'm now acting administrator for the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. Barry asked me to do this about 7 days ago, and I've been preparing just about every day since then to speak with you and talk with you about our addictions and mental health services in the state. I'm not going to go through the presentation booklet page by page. Instead, what I'm going to do is respond to the four questions that I understand that the committee was most interested in hearing about, and those are, how has the system been performing? And that will be broken down into the alcohol and drug treatment area, problem gambling treatment, mental health treatment, prevention. Dr. Mazerhart will be here to talk about state hospital performance. We've invited three people to help us today, and they're here. And although I had in mind that they might come a little bit later in the outline, I think I may ask them to speak with you a little bit sooner. They're each prepared to talk for about 10 minutes and describe from their perspective their view of the system and how it's been functioning. Another area that we've been asked to talk about is why the addictions mental health system exists at all, and I think I'll lead off with that and then move into the guest speakers. The third topic is how the system is organized. Madeline Olson, who is the assistant administrator and has spoken to the legislature on many occasions in the past, will help with that part. And finally, the last piece will be what can be expected from the budget request. So that's what I have in mind, and hope that that will meet the needs and, of course, be open to questions and other issues as they come up. I did want to comment that I understand that our prioritized list did arrive in the last 24 hours or so, and Mr. Britton suggested that I just acknowledge that it's here. The priorities that we tried to follow in putting that together are fairly simple. We tried to protect vulnerable children. We tried to protect vulnerable adults. We tried to protect the state's risk areas. I have to tell you, it was a daunting task. And as I looked at the list, it was really about down to number 15 before I felt any degree of comfort that we could easily defend the kinds of specific choices that we made. Most of what we do does involve a great deal of risk, and most of what we do involves working with very vulnerable children, adults, and older adults. So I would be happy to try to respond to any questions about how we did that, why one is ahead of another. It was a very difficult task, as I'm sure you can appreciate.
Madam Chair,
Senator Gordley,
but do we have that list?
It's right here. Would you like me to hand it out?
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, this is in two pages, so
Madam Chair, if it's okay, I will continue on. And I would like to acknowledge a few experts and colleagues and partners who are in the audience today. And they were here yesterday, and we'd hope to introduce them just by name, but I'd like to do that at this time. Rod Clark is the president of the Alcohol and Drug Providers Association, and I'm going to do my best not to use acronyms. I think I have an acronym-free set of notes here, but I may slip, and if I do, I'll pay the price.
Rosie just doesn't want to start.
Bruce Piper is also here from Douglas County and works for a program that actually has as an acronym-sounding name, but I believe it is the name of the agency, and that's ADAPT. I will be happy to pay 25 cents if it turns out it's an acronym. Bart Murray was here yesterday from Baker City. I'm not sure if he was able to stay over. Tim Hartnett from CODA in Portland. Sheila North from DePaul Treatment Centers. Rita Sullivan was here yesterday from OnTrack. I'd like to take particular note of Alan Levine. Alan is with Recovery Association Project. And I think one of the interesting new developments is to have people who are recovering from alcohol and drug problems themselves speaking more directly for themselves. And I think that's a very good step forward for this state. Would appreciate that Alan is here, taking his own time to be here. From the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, Oregon chapter, we have the executive director here, Stephen Eliza. We have Mike Durgan, who is going to speak to us in a few minutes, who's a member of the Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs. He's vice chair. He will be chair for the 03-05 biennium, and for that reason I asked him if he would talk with us for a few minutes about his perspective. Gina Furman, I believe, is here representing the Mental Health Directors Association. Jackie Mercer is here from the Native American Rehabilitation Association. There are many others who are in the audience, and I'd like to introduce them all, but I think I wanted to give credit and recognition to people who are very concerned about the services that are available in our state in the coming years. And they're also here to help keep me honest. And if I say something that they object to, I've asked them to talk with me about it. We'll go from there. I'm also not planning to, I will attempt to provide page references as I can identify them as we talk about things. I may slip up a few times, and for that I apologize in advance, but I will try to give a few page numbers as we go through. I would like to just say that personally, this is moving on my 35th year working in the field of mental health and addiction services. This is what I've chosen to do with my life. I agreed to help the state through this legislative session as acting administrator. I hope that I can help represent the interests of all Oregonians who have alcohol and drug and mental health issues, and particularly help the legislature in a very difficult task that you have. We're all acutely aware of the financial crisis that we're all in. And I'm in particular interested in making sure that we're able to talk about what some of the near-term effects of some of the cuts that we're having to contemplate right now on other risk areas that the state has, and I'll try to walk through some of those. What we've all tried to do for a number of years is avoid cost shifting, and I think we're not entirely successful in doing that. For example, I think we still have far too many people with addictions problems in our criminal justice system. We have far too many mentally ill people, youth and adults, in the criminal justice system. I think with seniors, we're still working to get a better handle on how best to outreach to them and deal with depression, alcohol and drug issues that they have. But I think that the challenges in not cost shifting are even greater now with the current crisis that we're facing than ever before. All right. Let me try to describe in just a few minutes why we have an addiction system in state government. It's obvious, I think, to everybody who's studied the issue that compulsive and excessive use of alcohol and other substances is an ancient problem. It didn't start recently at all. And America does seem particularly prone to generating its share of difficulties in this area. I've been struck, though, by reading, for example, Barry mentioned the book Betrayal of Trust by Lori Garrett, and there's some incredible chapters in there about the alcohol and drug issues that are now present in the former Soviet Union. Since my grandparents were born in Russia, that's an area that's always been of interest to me. And there are cultures who are, believe me, much, much more into an addictive kind of pattern But we have our share here. I think the thing that's encouraging, though, about alcohol and drug issues is that, as Barry and others have mentioned, they are treatable illnesses. One of the things that came became clear in the development of the prioritized list for the Oregon Health Plan that really struck me as I was studying this week was that untreated, it's expected that about 5% of the population will die within 5 years of untreated addiction problems. With treatment, the figure that I understand the Oregon Health Plan and the Health Services Commission worked from, with treatment, that reduces to about 2%. I think that's a very dramatic testimony to the value of alcohol and drug treatment on health care and longevity in particular. As Barry mentioned, the treatment for alcohol and drug problems is every bit as much on a par with the treatment of most other chronic medical conditions. I should note, too, that I'm starting off talking about alcohol and drug issues because I think one of the risks in what we've done in integrating the offices is to not put alcohol and drug on as high a plane as we might maybe 10 or 15 years ago. And part of what I hope my leadership will do will be to make sure that during the period of time that I'm working in this capacity that we really keep the alcohol and drug issues front and center. They're very critical. They're threaded throughout almost all of the problems and issues that state government deals with, whether it's child welfare, welfare reform, senior citizens. Seniors have about a 17% rate of alcohol and drug and prescription abuse rate. That's a very high rate. 80%, as Barry mentioned, of people who are incarcerated have alcohol and drug problems. 90% of the mentally ill who end up in our correction system have problems with alcohol and drugs. The risk of suicide, domestic violence, child abuse, all of those are very, very intimately tied into the excessive use of alcohol and drugs. Conversely, effective treatment reduces crime, family instability, it increases work productivity, school performance, health status. So I think it's really critical as we think about the funding for alcohol and drug problems that we recognize the carryover that it has into so many other areas that state government is involved with. Let me move and just talk briefly about gambling addiction because that's another part of our portfolio, if you will. I think the legislature was wise in setting aside the 1% for problem gambling addiction treatment. I think we're a national leader in that area.
Before you move on to gambling addiction, would you rank for us within alcohol and drug, where is the methamphetamine usage? Is it exceeding the heroin addiction, the cocaine addiction? Where is it in the rank order?
Madam Chair, it ranks very high. I'd have to go to the actual data sheet. I think we have that on page 220. And just looking at it quickly here, it looks like alcohol by admission for adults still carries the day with close to 60% of the admissions. It's on page 220. And do we have different numbering systems here?
We probably do.
We do. Okay.
No.
Oh, excuse me.
Behind the mental health and addiction services tab.
Thank you. As you can see, almost 20% of our admissions in adults have amphetamine problems. Heroin is at 7%. So I think that gives you a trend. In the youth area, marijuana, hashish, kind of takes the place, if you will, of alcohol in prominence. Alcohol is close to 30%. Methamphetamines or amphetamines is close to 10%.
From a treatment standpoint, is meth more difficult to treat than if you're treating some of the other drug addictions?
Madam Chair, I would probably defer to people who are more current right now with the actual treatment. I I know that we're making advances in the treatment of methamphetamine and amphetamine usage. One of the challenges in methamphetamine, the physiology of that, I'm told, is the changes that it creates in the structure and functioning of the brain. And we're seeing a lot of casualties in the psychiatric field as well. I think there are major challenges in that area, and maybe we can get some more specific information for you on that.
I raised that because if we, you know, from a standpoint of a budget and policy, if you have a growing number or, you know, on the increase of methamphetamine use, and if in fact the treatment modality takes longer or there's than the others, I think this body needs to know, you know, what's occurring that you're faced with. And so it would be helpful for us to have some of that information so that we're not treating that treatment you know, as though the problems don't exist there. And along with that, as I understand it, that the violence associated with that particular use is far greater than you're talking about some of the other drugs, which lends itself to some additional social problems that we may not have in other categories. And I'm thinking of the, you know, the increase in the child abuse statistics and the increase in domestic violence and some of those, because in talking to judges, they will tell you the difference between the person who comes before them that are methamphetamine users and those who are not. So I would just like to make sure that this my members, you know, have the information and the difference between the various drugs.
Madam Chair, we'll get some additional detail. And it recalls to mind, too, that I think about 60% of the women who are involved with child protective care are struggling with methamphetamine. So for young women, young mothers, the methamphetamine issue is a major problem.
Yeah. I don't know. We may, Mr. Britton, there is a film that has been produced that shows some of the homes and some of the effects of the methamphetamine users, and we may want to get them and show it to the members of this panel. It is very, it's not a pretty picture. So,
Madam Chair, I'll continue. I mentioned briefly gambling addiction. The problems there are parallel in some ways to the other addictions areas, with lots of difficulties around finances. Suicide rates are elevated. Family conflict is a huge problem in that area. I want to move on and fairly quickly talk about why is there a mental health system as well. Barry has already, I think, mentioned a number of those things. Actually, the first recognized person with mental illness in Oregon was in 1811 over up at Astoria. There was a man by the name of John Day, and I'm not sure if people are aware that the John Day, for whom two rivers in one town are named, was a real sturdy explorer-type guy. He was found wandering around and had been cared for by the Native Americans up in the Columbia River Gorge area, and the Astor Trading Party came by, picked him up, and took him and kept him over the winter. He improved enough over the winter that in 1812 he was ready to return to the East Coast or to the East somewhere. He became ill again. So to me, and died in Central Oregon somewhere. To me, the story illustrates a number of things. One is that treatment worked even in 1811, 1812. He did get better. He didn't have medications, and I'm not sure exactly what the nature of his problem was. But
You know, if you're using roots and barks, and we're still using roots and barks.
He also relapsed, which is one of the challenges that we always deal with, is how once you stabilize people, how do you keep them stable? And it also points out that these are very risky illnesses and that premature death is a critical thing. I think it also points out that it can happen to anybody. This was, as I said, a very sturdy explorer-type guy. He was described as a large, strapping man with a lot of physical strength. Okay. Barry mentioned the territorial government. There were five mentally ill people that, frankly, they didn't know what to do with in 1843. So there was a system set up at that point. I think $500 for each of the people was provided at that point. In 1861, Dr. J.C. Hawthorne opened the first state, what would later be called a state hospital. It was an insane asylum, literally called that at the time. I know Representative Westland always likes to hear this number. In 1877, the mental health costs for state government represented 52% of the total mental health, or 52% of the state budget. It's an incredible number. The point here is that people with mental illnesses have been with us since the very beginning of the state. It's a dilemma that we continue to struggle with in terms of what the best way to care for those people are, and the costs are certainly a very real part of state government and have been for a long time. The era of the state hospitals, as Barry mentioned, ran through about 1960. We peaked at close to 5,000 patients. I think it's also of interest in reading my history that on a single occasion in the 1940s, 44 patients died in a single episode in the state hospital. There was a program of sorts, I suppose, in which one of the patients was allowed to help with the meal preparation. Apparently it was very accidental, but he mistook strychnine for something that went into the scrambled eggs. 44 people died in our state hospital at that point. So again, I think it points out that these problems are difficult, and we've had some real tragedies in the state in the past. In 1961, the Mental Health Division was established, and, of course, the state hospital began to be somewhat less of the predominant mode of public mental health treatment at that point. So the era of community treatment really began in the 60s, although there were some child guidance clinics in the 1930s, and we've had some other programs that developed a little bit earlier. The National Alliance for the Mentally Ill estimates, and I think this is a good estimate, about one in four families are affected directly by mental illness. And it's primarily depression, manic depression, schizophrenia, severe anxiety disorders, phobias, etc. The burden in terms of lost productivity for people with mental illnesses is among the highest. I think Barry alluded to that as well. The World Health Organization has data on that. Suicide risk is extremely high, particularly with young adults who are involved with alcohol and drug. About 50% of people with severe mental illnesses have alcohol and drug issues. There was a study by Carol Caton in New York, I believe it was, that showed an elevated suicide rate of something like 210 times the national average for young adults with alcohol and drug problems and mental illness. So as you can see, we're dealing often with very lethal, potentially lethal illnesses if they're not treated. 40 to 60% of youth in juvenile detention facilities have severe emotional disorders or some emotional, diagnosable emotional disorder. A third of the homeless have mental illnesses. And I would also like to just point out violence among mentally ill is almost entirely a function of their mutual involvement with alcohol and drugs. In other words, if alcohol and drugs are factored out of the mental illness equation, people with mental illnesses really don't have any higher or lower rate of violence than the general population does. So I think I just want to make sure that we're aware of the interface of alcohol and drug and mental health issues. Older adults and children are particularly vulnerable. Older adults deal with elevated levels of depression. Suicide rates are much higher. I've mentioned the issues of prescription abuse and dependence. Children have obvious disadvantages if they're afflicted by a severe emotional disorder, in that it really interferes with their development.
Bob, given the number of these prescriptions that one begins to take when they become chronologically advantaged, one could kind of understand if there isn't some mechanism or some case management that somebody's trying to assist you through this when you're a little older, because the ability to remember all of the drugs that one is taking could probably produce some of those effects.
Madam Chair, I think that's right. I think we need to understand better what all the factors are in older adults, advantaged chronologically, as you say, people experience. In my experience, no one sets out to have an alcohol or drug problem, and there are often subtle things that can contribute to the vulnerability that people might have.
Looking at the addiction, not only but the addiction to drugs, when one is taking so many different ones of them, I think chemically can bring about some changes and influences as well. And I know during the the crisis that we've been experiencing. You know, I've received calls where individuals are taking 10, 12, you know, 15 and prescriptions. And you begin to look at if I'm older, you know, I can just imagine, and I am older, but, you know, if, I am chronologically advantaged, Dr. Bates, it's okay. But, you know, there are times when my memory is not that good if I took something at one time versus the other time, and I have that many to take if I'm not having somebody to help me manage. And I can, you know, just think if you're taking some of the codeine-type derivatives and some of the other stuff that are very habit-forming. The joys of becoming chronologically advantaged.
Well, we're all learning about that every day, so... I wanted to just mention briefly, why is there an Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services? And the intent, certainly, with the combining of the offices, and we're very aware of the controversies that surround that, but would be to try to do a better job of integrating care. When half of the people approximately who need alcohol and drug treatment have some sort of emotional and sometimes psychiatric disorders, and when half of the people with mental illnesses have alcohol and drug issues, there is a need for a lot of interaction. And I think our offices, you know, we can debate this, I'm sure, but I think that the office has promoted a lot more discussion back and forth at the state office level about the interactions of the problems. My own clinical background in the areas in which I've published the most has really been in co-occurring disorders. But frankly, I think it's very important also to recognize that not everyone has a co-occurring disorder. There are people who have only mental health problems, and there are people who have only alcohol and drug problems. And I think our office needs to continue to do a good job of recognizing that there are some truly separate sorts of disciplines, even though the issues do cross-cut across a lot of problem areas. I just want to also say that the idea of a central office at the state level is to manage as integrated and effective a system as we can provide. I think one of my concerns, too, is that we continue the movement toward evidence-based or science-based practices. I think there are a lot of great things that are happening in the last several years. I think Barry mentioned yesterday that we're involved with Dartmouth, New Hampshire Psychiatric Research Center, and some projects in Oregon. The alcohol and drug providers have been leaders in this state around the issue of science-based practices. There's a clinical trials network project that's going on. They're very actively seeking to do this in the most scientifically defensible way. And I think the state has a lot to be proud of in the alcohol and drug providers and in the community mental health center's interest in this area. The other thing that I think the state office is charged with doing is managing the state and, to some degree, the local budget risk. Because so many of the problems that we deal with can have cost shifting into other systems at the state and local level, I think that the best run and most efficient state system will also help the state deal with other risk areas. Let me just list some of what come to my mind. The state has risks in the area of the cost of state hospitalization. At times, that can be very expensive, partly because the federal government does not participate in the payment of state hospital beds for people between the ages of 22 and 64. Our state prisons and corrections, and I think that's a well-known issue, and I think that we all acknowledge that that's something we need to try to do a better job with. But when we don't provide good alcohol and drug and mental health treatment, it's going to put that much more pressure on our state prisons and corrections. The same
question. Can you provide us with some historical data that talks about if there has been an increase, what that increase has been over time, of the mentally ill in our state institutions, and also in our county jails? I don't know who's collecting that data. And you know, I know the public policy that we've done with respect to the state hospital. But what public policy have we done with respect to the increase in the mentally ill and others in our state prison? Is that population going up? And so it would be helpful if we had that kind of information.
Madam Chair, we'll get that information. I can tell you, just based again on some of my own historical research, is that one of the reasons state hospitals were developed in the 1840s to the 1860s was because they had identified at that time already, we're talking quite a few years ago, that there were too many mentally ill people ending up in state prisons. And that was one of Dorothea Dix's arguments for the creation of state hospitals, which were specialized to serve people with mental disorders. So in that sense, it's not, and again, as I read the history of mental health and addiction service, very few of the problems that we deal with now are entirely new. It's been with us. But I do think we have some trend data that we'll get for you.
Yeah, I guess from a policy standpoint, you know, and you have the knowledge, but I think for us to make informed and good decisions that we need to see some of those trend lines and changes of what's occurring in the environment.
Well, I'm sure we'll work on that. State juvenile justice, the Oregon Youth Authority, local juvenile authorities are also impacted by decisions that we make at state level around alcohol and drug and mental health treatment. Child welfare, foster care costs are influenced. Temporary assistance to needy families, I won't say the acronym, but you all know what it is another issue that can be affected by our decisions. Schools.
Can we fine them for thinking it?
I think so.
I think it's 25 cents. Thank you.
Okay. I'll be happy to contribute. Law enforcement obviously is affected by what decisions we make here. And last but not least, our local community hospitals and our emergency rooms. And it's really both, because the emergency rooms, as Representative Bates can tell us firsthand, deal with these issues on a nightly basis. Our community hospitals, 15 or 16 of them, have also stepped forward and created, I think, some of the best acute care hospital units in the country. We're very advanced in that area, but they also are affected by decisions that are made about the availability of alcohol and drug and mental health services. So I think there are just quite a number of risk areas that I think we have to take a look at here as we try to make some tough decisions about where to put dollars and how many dollars are available for that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Winters. I appreciate your comments. Last session I had the privilege of serving on Ways and Means Public Safety, and I'm thinking back to the presentations we had there from many of our correctional folks, and you're probably being too much of a statesman today and not making your statement strong enough. Because there truly is a correlation between funding of mental health and addiction services and the rate of reduction in corrections. And I think back as well to the little skit we had in front of us. And if we all remember when we took out the piece for mental health, how the system shut down. And so I guess that's just an observation. As I look at this list, my thoughts are for every dollar we don't put into this, we're probably going to end up putting $5 somewhere else. And so,
I'm sure, Representative Smith, there are some studies that show that. The studies are always subject, I think, to questioning about whether it's really 1 to 5 or 1 to 6 or 1 to 3. But if the principle is there, I think it's clear that when you provide treatment, you can reduce costs in a lot of these areas, particularly law enforcement and local jails and state prisons. I think at this point, what I would like to do is invite the guests who have traveled, in some cases from as far away as Baker City, to come and talk with us about their perspective. And I've asked each of them to have about 10 minutes prepared, and I think we should be in pretty good shape to get through that so that we can wrap up and then be finished at 3. The first person on my list is Mr. Mike Durgan. And Mike, why don't you just come on up and join us? As I mentioned, Mr. Durgan is the incoming or will soon to be the chair of the Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs. I've really gotten to appreciate Mike over the last year or so that I've had a chance to work with the council, and look forward to what he has to say.
Thank you, Bob. Madam Chairman, committee members, my name is Mike Durgan. I am from Baker City. I'm sorry to see a couple of your committee members aren't here. I was told to say hello to Representative Westland from Dr. Hoffman, so, and Senator Carter, Mike Nelson, asked me to say hello to her. Neither of them are here, but I'll report I did my duty. Representative, I am the vice chair of the Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs. I'm also the past president of the Board of Directors of New Directions Northwest. New Directions Northwest, which I used to refer to as NDN and hope I don't today, is a drug and alcohol treatment provider in eastern Oregon. They also run three programs in prisons, one at Shutter Creek at North Bend, the prison in Pendleton, and also Powder River Correctional Facility in Baker City. And actually, Representative Smith has been through those programs, so I'm somewhat talking to the choir here, but I'll refer to those as I go through here today, probably. Senator Gordley, you and I were on the Capitol steps together at a beer and wine tax rally a number of weeks ago, too, so it's good to see you. Madam Chairman, a number of weeks ago, you had a couple from Baker City come testify before your committee. They had both been in drug and alcohol treatment in Baker City. They were husband and wife. Their names were Bob and Sherry Forsythe. Mrs. Forsythe was in treatment at a women and children's program in Baker City, and Mr. Forsythe was in treatment in prison. And at the time that they were in treatment, according to their records, they were costing the state of Oregon approximately $75,000 a year. The husband was in prison, the wife was in long-term treatment, the children were in the custody of Department of Human Services. I almost did it. Their lives were in quite a bit of disorder. My wife is a counselor at a grade school in Baker City, and she asked me if I knew anybody that would come talk to sixth graders about alcohol and drugs, and I'd gotten to meet Mr. Forsythe, and I knew he would, and so I introduced them, and he did. I assume you have those letters in front of you, and the stack of letters to Dear Bob are the ones that these sixth graders wrote back to Mr. Forsythe thanking him for coming and talking to them about alcohol and drugs. I don't know if you remember him, but he's a rough-looking guy. He's got tattoos on his all over himself, and what I've learned is just he's a sweetheart of a person. And what they would tell you is that they had, through their opportunity to access treatment for their alcoholism and drug addiction, today they're able to go do prevention work. And I would suggest that that's what happens in most cases of folks that have the opportunity to do that. So today they're not costing the state of Oregon $75,000 a year. They are both employed. They pay taxes. They have paid all of their fines and fees back to the Department of Human Services, and they do this outreach and prevention work on their own. As someone had mentioned already today, we have study after study now that shows that alcohol and drug issues drive many other social service costs. 2 years ago, what was then the Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs did a biannual report that They presented to us on the Governor's Council, and their very first paragraph stated that alcohol and drug abuse issues cost every citizen of the state of Oregon $1,000 a year. The Oregon Coalition to Reduce Underage Drinking, which I used to call OCRA, did a similar study last year, and they came up with a figure of $800 a year. Significant money. And that's everyone that's a citizen of the state was their study that are paying that for the fallout of alcohol and drug abuse. It's just clear to me that investment in alcohol and drug treatment and prevention is a financially prudent activity. As Representative Smith mentioned, the Finnegan report showed for every dollar spent, there's a savings of $5.60, I think was his number, and there are others that show an even larger savings downstream. The fact is that if we do not treat these folks, they will not simply disappear. They'll end up in our police cars, in our jails, in our courts, in our emergency rooms, are simply wandering around aimlessly in your backyards and mine. I believe it's very important to realize that treatment prevention activities are not singular events. Rather, they're ongoing processes. And Senator Winters, you asked a minute ago about the continuum of care for methamphetamine specifically, but I would suggest that treatment as a rule is a longer-term process than most of us recognize. It isn't a matter in many cases of just going for an inpatient program, getting out of there and not having a problem ever again. That just isn't realistic. But what we learned is that if we provide a continuum of care for people, they do get well. In that regard, I believe recent budget cuts have had devastating effects on outpatient services in our state already. Our greatest fear at this time, I believe, is that even further cuts, if further cuts are made, particularly in the Oregon Health Plan, the same thing will happen in residential treatment, and that this state will effectively be out of business as far as treating and preventing these diseases. The Governor's Council is very concerned about that trend. We spend a lot of time talking about that. At the same time, I want to mention that we would like to advise you that we have a tremendous amount of respect and confidence in the current leadership of the Department of Human Services, and particularly the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. We think we're in very good hands at this point in time, and I have not always felt that way. During the last session, which was really my first opportunity to get involved in this at all, I was very disappointed in some of the input that you got. And Madam Chair, that was to be the end of my presentation and to ask you to read the letters you have. However, a couple of weeks ago, the same wife I mentioned came home and she said, Bob Forsythe did a wonderful job of talking to the sixth graders, but nobody has talked to the fifth graders and the fourth graders. Well, I'm also an alcoholic. And I'm also a newlywed alcoholic, and I was not about to tell this lady, no, I wouldn't do that. So I went and spoke to her fourth and fifth graders. And literally, Sunday afternoon, as I was packing my bags to come here today, one of the fourth grade teachers brought this stack of letters, and she knocked on the door and presented them to me as I was getting ready to leave. And these are letters that fourth and fifth graders had written to me after I did my presentation to them. I want to read you just a couple of these, and I explain why they had such an impact on me. The first one, I don't know where these are on your list. I'll read them, and then maybe you can find them later. It said, "Dear Mr. Durgan, I would like to thank you for coming and helping us understand how bad it can be to start drinking and what it can do to your body. I know you probably hurt when you got a hole. The reality is I've got a fairly significant scar in my stomach, and I showed these kids that, and that seemed to have the most impact of anything I said. Almost all the letters refer to the hole in my stomach someplace.
Well, you know what makes an impact.
Yes, I do now. No, I didn't. I really like the fact that you were kind enough to give me your card and talk to Mike. And I remember this little girl, and when we got all done, she would ask me some very perceiving and perceptive questions. I knew there was somebody in her life that she was talking about, and I gave her a business card, and I said, I don't know who you're talking about, but if they'd like to call me, you give them this, and perhaps they will. And she goes on to say, you have not heard from him because I'm a little scared to give it to him because I don't know how he would react. I will give it to him sooner or later. I am just waiting for the right time, if you know what I mean. I mean, I learned that your body can be well affected by drinking. Thank you so much. Your best friend, Danny Zoe Sprite. Now, I don't know if she's, I don't remember whether this Mike is a stepfather or an uncle or whoever, but I know when I left there, I believe that little girl had something to hang on to. I believe she had a glimmer of hope that there was some place for Mike to go that somebody could help him. I had another letter. It says, Dear Mr. Durgan, thank you for coming to our classroom and telling us how bad alcoholism is and how bad it can affect your body. I learned that alcohol is very addictive, and once you're addicted to it, it's very hard to quit. Thank you for telling me what it was like to be an alcoholic and difficult your life used to be. I hope that I never become an alcoholic. thank you for coming, and I hope you come back to visit us soon. That was sincerely Annie, and I'll stop with this one. And this one has a picture of a cross out of a cigarette and a bottle of some kind. Dear Mr. Durgan, thank you for all the information on what can happen if you start smoking and drinking. And in big capital letters it says, I will never start. And it's all because of you and your wife. I love answering questions and love drawing. Because of you, I will have a happy and healthy life. I will remember the most when you told us about the hole in your stomach. I thank you, Bunches, your friend, Samantha Ragsdale. Thank you very much, Madam Chairman.
Well, thank you. I just have one question, and I don't know what the class size was, but also what the gender numbers in the class were. I was just flipping through these as you were reading, and I did note that the female gender wrote you more letters than the males did.
Madam Chair, I think it's the luck of the draw. I asked my wife just to pick the top 10 or 12 off of Mr. Forsyth's letters, and I just did the same. So
I would just thought maybe we got it.
There were about 60 kids all together that I talked to.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Winters. Mike, I'm so proud that you'd come down here today and share all this with you. You and I kind of came into politics together at about the same time, although we're going down different paths. I have to tell you, I consider you a very dear friend, but I am a little disappointed in that I have not seen this hole in your stomach. And what I would encourage this committee is if you ever are going through Baker City and you ever have an hour or two, stop in and visit Mike and take one of the tours that he offers, because it truly, truly is eye-opening to see the programs and the services that are being offered and the difference it's making in folks' lives. And so, Mike, thank you,
you bet,
for all the work you do.
You bet.
Thank you for
You're welcome,
taking
ma'am.
The time to come.
You betcha.
Thank you, Mike. Madam Chair, the next speaker is Angela Kimball. And Angela, come on up. Angela is a member of our Mental Health Planning and Management Advisory Council. And I'll let her speak for herself.
Okay, I'm a little nervous. So, Chair Winters and members of the committee, my name is Angela Kimball, and I'm here as a member of the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services Planning and Management Advisory Council, as a representative of the National Alliance of the Mentally Ill Oregon, and especially as a mother of a child who has a serious mental health disorder. This is my personal story, and I'd like to share it in order to give voice to my fellow advisory council members and to the thousands of Oregonians, your constituents, who have similar stories. And I'd like to add that my story is one of hope, of the tremendous promise that comes from effective mental health services. And this promise, this hope, is something that rallies those of us who unite for mental health services. In fact, we now have a coalition that's never existed before called Mental Health Matters. And we consist of diverse groups such as the Mental Health Association of Oregon, Oregon Advocacy Center, the National Alliance for Mentally Ill, the Campaign for Patient Rights, Oregon Family Support Network, and the Association for Community Mental Health Programs and Coalition for Responsible Treatment. And this coalition is united around a shared agenda, around our belief in the efficacy and the need for mental health services. And now I'll tell you the story that brings me here. I am the divorced mother of two teenage boys, 13 and 16. My 16-year-old has been diagnosed with bipolar disorder for nearly 4 years, but we've known all his life that something was wrong. When my 16-year-old was still a toddler, I had a thought that no mother should ever have. I wondered if my little boy would be in McLaren on his 16th birthday. I really did. It was because he didn't respond to me the way other children did. He didn't respond to requests, to explanations, to discipline, to normal routines, to daily life and love. I didn't admit this thought to anyone because I was ashamed of having it, because I love my son more than anything in this world. I struggled for years with parenting classes and behavior management techniques. I went to, it seemed like, hundreds of counselors, and I stayed at home so that I could be there and pick up my child from school every day and try and manage his behavior. I prayed that he would mature, but instead he got bigger and he got angrier. He made little eye contact. He spoke little. He was hard to control. And his responses were unpredictable. He'd be sweet one day, withdrawn another, and inexplicably enraged another. We never knew what would be broken, who might be hurt, or when it would happen. We walked on eggshells. And then, in fifth grade, my son's teacher said, "Angela, honey, I've taught hundreds of kids, and I know when boys are misbehaving and when something's wrong. And there is something wrong. You just keep looking for help. You'll know it when you find it." And those simple words resulted in a huge change of heart for me. I'd never wanted to rely on drugs because I believe that parents should know how to raise their child and take responsibility for them. And I didn't feel like I could put a label like mental illness on my little child. I didn't feel like my family had mental problems. And I was far more ready to believe that I had failed as a parent than to believe that there was something wrong with my child. But those teacher's words prompted me to search for help. And a few months later, we were able to see a child psychiatrist who I believe saved our lives. He told me to throw away the parenting books and quit beating myself up. And he said he believed my son when my son told him, "I want to be good. I just don't feel like I can." He asked my son to try a medication just once and let him know if it helped. At the next day, my son came home from school and he said, "Mama, my head doesn't hurt anymore. I never knew it hurt. I just felt like slugging people all day long, and now I can kind of ignore them." It broke my heart to realize that I and others had spent years focusing on how he had tormented others without realizing that it was he who was tormented and by something that could be so simply helped. It took 2 more years to get a combination of medications that stabilized my son with his bipolar disorder. And during that time, before he was stabilized, he entered adolescence. He ended up in the back of a police car more than one time. He was in the community justice center. He was in a diversion program. He was hauled to psychiatric crisis centers. And he was kicked out of school and placed in a program with stainless steel lockup rooms and guards. He braided a noose and made a suicide attempt. But my son believed in his doctor, and his doctor believed in him. And together, and with the help of a supportive family and wonderful professionals in the community, they made progress. We stopped walking on eggshells. The police stopped coming to my door. The neighbors started talking to me. My son started smiling. He started making friends. He started enjoying school, mowing lawns, and excelling at art. He started living life, and I did too. And on his 16th birthday, my son wasn't in McLaren. He was graduating out of an alternative school for troubled youth into a special classroom at a very large public high school, Cleveland High in Portland, Oregon. And I never dreamed he would get that far, that he would be in a high school with his peers, that he would get an A, that'd be staying out of trouble. And now he has his own dreams. He wants to graduate. He wants to go to college and get an art degree. He wants to be a chef. To my way of thinking, it's really so very, very simple. His success gives us all the hope and promise that treatment works. I've told you my story of hope, but I also have to tell you about my fears. One of the reasons I'm here is because I'm worried about my son. I'm employed part-time now, and I don't have insurance coverage that pays for my son's medications. I don't know how I'll afford the $350 per month in medications that keeps him so well. And I'm not eligible for assistance programs. And I worry about what will happen if he should go into a crisis, because counties have already had their crisis service funding cut. My son's symptoms are in control, and Alex believes in his future. But before this legislative session is over, my son will be an adult. I will not be able to protect and care for him forever. He deserves to have his future begin with access to community mental health services that help him remain stable and productive, not a future in the back of a police car, in a jail cell, or in a psychiatric ward. Again, mental health services work. Neglecting mental health care costs. Thank you so much, Chair Winters and members of the committee.
Angela, I want to thank you for coming and sharing your personal experience. And I know sometimes it isn't easy. But I think it's a message that this body and others in this body need to hear. It's always gratifying when individuals who have the life experiences come and share those experiences with us. And I just thank you for your courage in coming here today. And I offer my prayers that your son attains his goals and his objectives. I'm glad that he wants to go into art, but I'm also pleased that he wants to be a chef. Those of you who know that I owned a restaurant, and so cooking is the thing that I enjoy. But we hear you, and access to service is important, as well as the importance of assuring that he's able to have the medication that he needs. So thank you for sharing with us.
Thank you, Chair Winters and members of the committee.
Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, thank you. I also echo, and I know all the members of the panel do, the strength of your testimony and appreciate it. I would like to have a copy of your testimony, if you could do that, and I suspect all the members would. We have many occasions to speak publicly about these issues, and the strength of your testimony is powerful. And with your permission, I would like to be able to use excerpts of your testimony as occasions may arise in the future.
Chair Winters and Senator Morris, thank you so much, and I will make copies available, and you are quite welcome to quote anything you would like.
And I'm certain that Mr. Britton will Xerox and Forrest for each member of this panel, and again, we thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Winters, now I'd like to ask Mitch Anderson, who is president of the County Mental Health Association, County Mental Health Directors Association, to come forward and talk just briefly about the state or the county mental health perspective.
Thanks, Bob. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mitchell Anderson. I am Deputy Administrator of the Benton County Health Department in charge of the Mental Health, Addictions, and Developmental Disabilities programs. I've been working, leading those programs for the past 6 years. And in this last year, I also was elected president of the Mental Health Association, Community Mental Health Programs. I have spent these last 6 years very involved in all aspects of design, development, and provision of services for mental health and addictions. I have provided for you some notes from my testimony today. What I really came to talk about was county perspective on where we're headed, what the result of some of the financial cuts have been, and some suggestions for the future. Specific to Benton County, over 500,000 in annual funding for alcohol and drug and mental health services were lost with the latest cuts. That's an annualized number. That's about a third of our budget. That resulted in 8 clinical staff, 3 administrative staff being laid off. That's 30% of our staff. You heard from Barry Cast, I believe, yesterday that by June, approximately 1,800 clinical staff will have been laid off statewide. Currently, that number, already having been laid off, is about 1,300. In Benton County, approximately 547 adults and 54 children annually living with mental illness will not get outpatient and crisis services as a result of those cuts. Approximately 117 persons annually will not get treatment for alcohol or other drugs. Barry Cass said that approximately 125,000 people were served in the mental health system across the state, and about 70,000 were served in alcohol and drug treatment programs. If you were to roughly generalize Benton County's numbers based on the number of FTEs we lost and the number of people served to that 1,300 clinical positions lost in the system, that comes up to around 80,000 people statewide who might not get services. It's a huge number. These cuts are very devastating on community mental health programs. Some counties will and some counties will not come out of this with services intact. Benton County is fortunate in that the local community and the county invests funds in the mental health services. Other counties do not have that local investment. I don't know what we would do in Benton County if the local funds weren't invested. I don't know that we would have much of a program at all right now. It would be whittled down so small, I don't know what we could provide. How are we coping with that now? Well, one of the things about counties is we're very resilient. We've the mental health system has always been sorely underfunded. We've had to scrap for everything we've gotten. We've worked hard to put together continuums of care and make linkages that work for the citizens who need our services. We're once again doing that, even in the face of these cuts. We're significantly restructuring our programs, consolidating services. Benton County has had a program called the Kairos Program, a community support services program that has been open for years and years. As a result of these reductions, that program is actually closing its doors. We will still be able to maintain some of the services, but it's a big loss to our community. We're having to limit who gets in our front door, really moving to a triage system, which really flies in the face of trying to provide preventative, proactive services. We're forced to keep what little capacity we have for those most seriously in need. By doing that, while we help those most seriously in need, many others also become seriously in need because they couldn't get the early, briefer interventions that helped stabilize them and keep them from going to the higher-end services. In Benton County, we're working to maintain access for all citizens. While we may not have treatment resources available to everyone, we felt that it was very important that at least all citizens have the access to talk to a mental health clinician or A&D clinician and at least get some help. We may be only able to offer advice over the telephone, but we think these services are so important to our community that we need to offer something. We're utilizing our community partners, but a lot of our partners have had funding reductions, too. We're all strapped and trying to make the best of a bad situation. We're also consolidating our administrative functions. Part of closing our Kairos program was to bring those services back in-house so that we could reduce reception staff and billing and support functions to try and maintain what little structure we could. My point that counties, the local mental health authority, and the public and private community mental health centers that we work with are effective. We're able to shift our services and programs to meet needs. We can work within limited budgets and are committed to serving and supporting those with mental illnesses and our addictions. We need to have a continuum of services. Small silos of types of services don't work. As we're looking ahead at the budget, we really need to look at, even with limited funding, that we have funding in all the different areas so that you can provide a continuum. That's where we find the efficiencies and the effectiveness. What about the future? During this last year, counties were all involved in a planning process to come up with a blueprint plan for mental health services. Those plans now look kind of like pie in the sky because they were based on new funding and they were based on working towards an ideal system based on the findings of the Mental Health Alignment Work Group. Those plans are still there. They're still something we want to strive for and still will strive for. There are pieces in those plans that we can do without funding, and we will continue to work in that direction. I want to say that I have a great deal of confidence in the new leadership in the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. Bob Nickel has been a very strong supporter of community programs. He's extremely knowledgeable about the system, about the needs of consumers. He's a shining light in terms of in this troubled time, and feel very good about the partnership we can form to continue to move forward. In Benton County, we're actively working towards evidence-based practices. We're seeking the development of a federally qualified health center to further integrate public health, primary care, and behavioral health for our citizens, particularly safety net citizens. We're looking at every avenue we can to bring additional revenues in and build an effective service system. Again, the major point, the local community behavioral health system is the best possible way to meet the needs of vulnerable Oregonians coping with addictions and or mental illness, and is a system that is continuously changing to improve quality and effectiveness of services and outcomes. The system works when there's a full range of services. Prevention through crisis and acute care. Don't let this system and those who depend on it wither and die. We're teetering right now. As I was putting together my testimony, I knew this was ways and means. As I deliberated, well, what's the way versus what's the mean, I thought I'd go to Webster's Dictionary and look that up. And lo and behold, ways and means is in the dictionary. And it says methods and resources. So that helped me a little bit. So I want to talk about the ways, the methods. And I saw the counties and the community behavioral health system as the ways, the methods. We have to support and invest in the community behavioral health system. Any investment saves substantial dollars that will have to be paid out for emergency and hospital levels of care, corrections and criminal justice costs, and costs in lives, suffering, abuse, neglect, and lost productivity. You've heard other testimony today about the cost savings of proactive preventative services. In partnership with the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, every dollar invested through the local mental health authority will be utilized to provide positive outcomes through locally planned and prioritized and proven practices. We do work effectively. We help people. The means, the resources, this is the tough one. The state is in a huge fiscal crisis, and moving ahead is hard to even think about how we would do that. I have several points I wanted to make. While I really appreciate Gene Thorne's and Barry Cast's intent regarding county participation in state planning and prioritization, intent's not enough. If the system's going to work, it has to be built from locally generated plans and priorities. It has felt that in this rushed process with financial cuts, that the counties have not been partners at the table fully, that we sometimes are put in a position of reacting rather than being able to help build the system from the ground up. We have to be involved in budget planning from the start. It's hard for us to support the priorities that have been put forward by the division and by the Department of Human Services at this point when we really haven't felt like we've been fully involved in developing those from the start. We have concerns about some of the things that have been cut, in particular crisis services. We appreciate the legislature restoring some kids' mental health funding, but again, it provides an example of where input at the local level is not being included. The kids' mental health funding was probably the last thing that needed to be restored. Kids' mental health services were not very dramatically impacted because of EPSDT I'm going to have to pay up. Early periodic screening, diagnosis, and treatment.
Rosie will accept.
Under the Oregon Health Plan, where we really needed funds were crisis services. All the crisis funding has been taken away. Any funds provided for mental health services need to be provided in less categorical streams. Community mental health centers need to be able to shore up locally what are the critical needs. We have plans. We know locally what's needed. Large numbers of categorical streams don't support local planning and prioritization, and they don't promote efficiency and effectiveness. To the contrary, they generate administrative tracking burden and block blending and integration. Of the approximate $177 million in the community system of care that's been talked about that still remains, only about $11 million of that is invested in outpatient services. The rest is primarily in residential kind of high-end services. And it appears that the budget is defining the most vulnerable in our state as those currently in beds, and it denies the reality that people in the community mostly depend on the threat of community mental health center treatment to keep their lives from unraveling. We need to look at ways to develop shared risk management with the state. We need to look at ways to bring funding that has been piecemealed out to other programs and departments for mental health services back, consolidated in mental health. Since I came to this state 5 years ago, I was aware that there were pockets of funding in adult corrections, juvenile departments, different places to support mental health services. And always questionable, why is that? Why is not the funding consolidated so that the mental health system has a base of funding, and that really then what occurs is there are administrative rules or legislation that says you must partner and provide these services across the system. I think I will kind of move along. My notes cover a lot of my more detailed points, and just kind of close with saying that we have to work in partnership to assure those with mental illnesses and addictions have access to the help they need, and that the help is cost-effective and produces outcomes that benefit all Oregonians. I ask your support in several areas. Counties need to be included from the beginning. We can create solutions. Don't let the critical systems collapse. We're aware of the fiscal crisis and that there's no certainty of new revenue. Mental health and addictions treatment system was underfunded before the cuts taken this year, and we must find new revenue to support these necessary services. Funding must be found for crisis services. That is an essential support to the community. Any investment in community behavioral health care will save the state money, and I believe that there are existing resources that can be better utilized or shifted to keep the community system of care from crumbling. We have to look hard and find those. Thank you.
Thank you. And I know that you had planned for Gina Furman, but we're running short, and if Gina doesn't mind, because I know she probably has a lot to share with us, and we'll take her testimony tomorrow. And you talked about the funding streams, there is some work that's going on with the counties, with Gina and others, to talk about, to see what the potential and the prospects are with a pilot model of block grant funding. So we are trying to work on that issue. But I have a question of Bob, because I just the staff just told me you're from Kansas, and by the way, I'm a Jayhawker too, and we were talking about some of the federal matching that is being done in Kansas, and I would like to talk to you a little later to see if they're doing something in leveraging dollars that we're not perhaps doing, and perhaps we can learn something from them in order to maximize the dollars. So, Bob, I'd like to get with you and to talk about some of those potentials. I did share with, we talked about Kansas, and of course the Menninger Foundation really influences a lot what happens in mental health, and those, you're shaking your head in the state of Kansas, particularly in Topeka.
Madam Chair, you're right there. They've fallen on hard times too, however, and I understand that they've had to sell their campus in Topeka.
Really?
So the times are changing there.
Yeah. Well, with that, I hated to hear that. I guess I'll have to go home for a family reunion and find out what's going on. We are adjourned until tomorrow. Thank you very much.